Good afternoon. So, last time we went through how XP6 dealt with exceptions other than system calls, which had most of the same code paths. It was just that once we got to that trap function where XP6 handles all the kinds of exceptions, it just went to a different switch case or if statement. And that's why it was handled differently, and we took actions appropriate for whether it was I/O or timer interrupt and so on. And in this process, it came up that often we wanted to switch to another process or eventually do that. And we talked about how that was done in XP6. And we learned that this takes advantage of the XP6 mechanism for handling exceptions, and that's how we handle saving all the stuff the application was dealing with. Because we save that to handle our exceptions to begin with, even when we aren't switching to another program, just because the kernel wants space to work without interfering with the registers the application was trying to use and the stack the application was trying to use. So we take advantage of the fact that we save all that information anyways, and we just switch the kernel stuff when we eventually decide, oh, wait, this exception's special because I want to switch to something else in the middle of it. And we saw that we had this sort of magic function that we called in the kernel to switch to another thread. And the way that worked is that it would save the current thread state on its stack, and then it would switch to the stack of the other thread and restore that other thread state. And because we can't just switch stacks in C, this has to be written in assembly. But otherwise, it was fairly straightforward. Push everything we care about on the stack, change the stack pointer, pop everything we care about from the new stack where it was saved previously. We mentioned that the combination of the saving and restoring on exception handlers in this function was most of our context switch. There was a little missing piece that we needed to handle the address space switch, which we kind of glossed over because we're going to talk a lot more about how virtual memory works later in the semester. So any questions on these topics from the last time before I move on? So one thing we were missing with this switch function is that the switch function effectively returned to another call to switch. And this doesn't give us a way to start a thread to begin with, so we need to handle that. So returned to another thread's call to switch, but what if we didn't have a call to switch, which we can't for the first time a thread is running? So the trick that XP6 and most threading libraries and operating systems use for this is that we're going to set up a stack as if we just called switch. So we didn't actually call switch, but we're going to write everything to the stack that would have been written if there were a real call to switch. And we're going to do that as part of creating a new thread. And this has the advantage that, well, we could avoid doing this, but then we'd have to have like two versions of switch, a switch to new thread switch and a normal switch, and instead we can have one version of that tricky assembly code and just have the setup code be a little different. So in XP6, this code is in a function called alloc-proc, which makes a new process. Every process is one thread, and this sets up the kernel stack because that's what switch cares about. We also have to create the user stack at some point, but that is handled elsewhere. And to do that, a kernel stack's allocated, and we have to set an initial stack pointer. And we just set the stack pointer to the top of the stack. And then the code below this is going to take that stack pointer, add something at that address, and decrement it. Or decrement it, then add something at that address, just like pushing would manually, but we're doing it in C code here. So this is the stack pointer for a new thread. And the first thing we're going to do is allocate space for the trap frame, that is the saved registers that would happen at a call to trap. So we're going to pretend that we're in the middle of a call to trap, and in order to do that, we have to have the stuff that would be on the stack before we call trap. So this is adding that, and that stuff is the saved user registers. So this is how when we create the new thread, we figure out, well, where are the user registers going to go? So somewhere else in this code, we're going to say, this is the location of main, and we're going to save that in there. And this is the initial user stack pointer. We're going to save it in those user registers. We allocate space for that first and store a pointer in this P, which is going to represent our process. So that's going to be used later to like set things like where it's the user stack pointer going to be when we start this thread. And we eventually return back to user mode. Then, because we know that this is going to be a call to trap, we're going to allocate space for the return address that trap's going to read from the stack. And we happen to have a label in the assembly that calls trap called trapret, so we know where that is in the C code. So trapret's just the instruction after the call trap, and that's named just so we can name it, use it here, and place it on the stack. So when trap eventually gets returned to, it's going to read it off the stack and go to the code which exits from an exception. Then we want to add a call to switch to the stack. Because remember, we're going to pretend we're in the middle of a call to switch, so we're going to add the registers for a call to switch. And to do that, we're going to give a switch a place to return to. And the place we return to in XV6 is this function called forkret. It's called forkret because, as we'll learn later today, the system call to create a new process is called fork. So this is the last half of a fork. And this code that switches returns to contains a little bit of setup code for a new process. And the return address for forkret is going to be, return address for switch is going to be forkret. That's going to then return to the return from, as if we return from trap, even though we don't go through trap, but that's okay. And we also allocate space for our saved registers. And this includes both the saved return address for switch and all those other saved registers that switch would have pushed on the stack. And this is represented by this struct context, which has entries for the return address and the four registers that are pushed on the stack. We just allocate space and set them all as zero because we don't care what they are. So now we have this new stack, which says we're in the middle of a call to switch with registers ready to pop off the stack. And when we return from that, we're going to go to forkret. Forkret's going to return to where trap returns to, and that code's going to read these user registers and then return from the exception we're in. We know we're in an exception because that's the only way the kernel runs. So this means that when we switch to this, we'll run our setup code and fork. We'll first restore these registers, change our stack pointer, most importantly, and set the registers to some initial value, and then we'll run the process setup code. Then we're going to return and restore the user registers and start running the new user thread. This is our new thread setup. So questions about how this works? Yes?
Can you explain one more time what forkret and trapret do?
So forkret is a little function that contains the code that we want to run when we start a new thread in that new thread. So you can look it up at what it does in XV6, but it's just a little bit of bookkeeping, basically. And then trapret is just where trap returns to. So it's pretending we're returning from trap. Okay. Other questions? Yes?
When we allocate that trap frame, what are we saying the user registers were saved as? Are those also just set to zero?
So the question is, why do we say the user registers are saved as? Or they're set to zero? So they are not set to zero because we need some things not to be zero. So there's some code I'm not showing you, which is going to, for example, set the user stack pointer to a value that makes sense. and set the user saved program counter to a value that makes sense. I believe all the other ones are probably set to zero, because the idea is the user can write code to set those registers if they need them. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So one thing that this function reveals is that we have this struct proc. And this is a data structure that represents, in XV6, a process, and it's, in XV6, single thread. Every process in XV6 has one thread. You might say, that's not how things work today. We'll talk about that in several weeks. But in XV6, every process has one thread, and struct proc is what we commonly call a process control block. It's the information about a process. It's all the bookkeeping. So it's struct proc. And you can look at its definition and see, here are all the things we need to know about a process. So we have its current register. So we have a pointer to its current trap frame, if it's in the middle of a system call. So it's saved user registers, if it's not running right now. If it is running, that's going to point to something, but it's not useful because its registers are on the CPU. We also have a pointer to its context for switch, which is its kernel stack pointer. So we can switch to it if it's not running right now. If it is running, that's not going to be useful because its stack pointer is on, kernel stack pointer, if it's running in kernel mode, is on the CPU. And if it's not running in kernel mode, you can't switch to it. You need to have it interrupted first. We have a pointer to its kernel stack, not the stack pointer, but the beginning of the stack. So we can like free the kernel stack when it's done. We have information about its state. Is it running? Is it waiting? Is it finished? Is it being set up but not ready to run yet? And we're going to need this later to know about, like, when I want to find a program to run, how do I find it? In XV6, we scan for one with the appropriate state. And we also, in addition to having the state, we have, like, an explicit should this be killed variable. And this chan, which is a badly named variable for what is it waiting for if it's waiting. So we can figure out whether we need to wake it up, like if we get a key press. This is how we figure out what's waiting on a key press. We have a process ID. So this exists so we can identify this process in system calls. For example, XV6 has a system call to kill, to terminate a process. And we need to say, what process do we want to terminate? We identify it with this ID. We have to know about the program's memory. And this is represented with, in XV6, a size, because XV6 is a very simple way of managing a program's memory. It just has address 0 to the end of its heap. We'll talk about exactly how this laid out there. So we have to know, where's the end of its heap? That's SC, size. And we also have to have its page table, that mapping the processor uses. And that's what page dir points to. We need to have open files. So this array O file is the list of all the files this process has opened. And we also have its current directory, which is what CWD is. And there's a bit of extra information. See, this is information that's managed for each process. You know, that's going to be useful for us in things like system calls. And XV6, we have this struct proc, and we need to be able to get it. So XV6 has a function, myproc, which retrieves the current struct proc. In some of the trap code I've shown you, you've seen this. You might wonder, so how does this work? How do we know what the current process is? And the answer is we're going to use global variable. Now, XV6 supports multiple cores, so we actually want to have a separate variable for each core. So the way XV6 does that is it has a global variable, which is an array of size equal to the maximum number of cores it supports. That's what NCPU is. And then there's a function which retrieves the element of that array corresponding to the current core. It figures out what the current core is by reading a special register indicating what core number is this. And then that contains a pointer to the current process. And whenever we do a context switch, we're going to change that pointer so we can keep track of what process we're running. So that's something we're going to do manually before we call switch. Yes?
What if we don't manually do it before switch?
So question is, what if we didn't do this and we switched to another process anyways? Then our things like our system call would call my proc, it would get the wrong pointer, and really weird things would happen, right? Like, we'd be running another program, it would like try to write something, and we write it using the other program's information about what, like, what file to write to.
That seems pretty important, so shouldn't that be the switch function itself?
So the question is, yeah, what if doing this is pretty important, shouldn't that be in the switch function? So it turns out that there's going to be a wrapper for the switch function, known as the scheduler, which is what we'll almost always call, and it's going to handle this along with also choosing what program to switch to. So yes, x86 does make it hard to avoid this because we always call the, not just switch to a particular process, we call switch to whatever, what process is best right now. And that function also handles changing this pointer. Okay, so that's how that works. So x86, I mentioned, is based on Unix version 6. And in this class, we're going to be talking a lot about Unix. And some of you don't use a Unix-like OS. And so there's reasons for that. So one is that we have source code. And that's a little harder to get for Windows and things like that. And you might have used it in 2150 and remember how. It's been around for a while, and we have a teaching OS that imitates it. I don't have a teaching OS that imitates Windows internals. But we're talking about, what is Unix? So Unix, sorry, this is very small. So we have a timeline here, and there was an operating system developed in 69 at AT&T, and then there were later versions of it, which were called Unix, versions 1 through 4, then 5 through 6, then 7, and then 8. And a lot of people based operating systems on this. And where there are lines, they actually like shared code. And then there are some operating systems which imitate the Unix interface, like Linux over here, but don't actually share code. So there's this whole giant family of many, many operating systems which share this common ancestor, and therefore share common conventions and common interfaces. And in the 90s, there were a ton of these, including a bunch of them which were commercial products, competing commercial products, all of which shared source code with this ancestor at AT&T. So it's very important, was very widely used. And we're going to talk about Unix, but we want to talk about, well, what does Unix really mean? You know, one option is you could say, well, it means something that's something based on this thing that was originally called Unix. But often we say Linux is kind of Unix, even though it doesn't actually share source code with that because it imitates it. But we're going to talk more about not real Unix, but something called POSIX. So in the 90s and 80s, when there were all these different commercial vendors making different Unix-like operating systems, people wanted to like have software they wrote and sold that would run on Unix. And this was kind of problematic because you needed to test your software on Solaris and AIX and Xenex and System 5 and HPUX and NetBSD and FreeBSD and NextStep in order to know that, you know, all the people could buy it. And to help out with this, the makers of all these variants of Unix came together and made a standard called the Portable Operating System Interface. And basically this tried to have a interface you could write your code based on and would work on all the Unix-like OSs. And this has been revised and revised up until like the latest revision is 2017. It's actively revised. And most current Unix-like OSs, including Linux, OS X, so on, try to follow this standard. And this is what we'll be talking about. Now, POSIX is specified for portability, so the idea is that you can write an application to POSIX and it will work. This means that it doesn't specify all the things we're talking about. So it says, this is how the library and shell interface works, because you're writing code for the C library. So it says, this is what the C library stuff does, and this is how the shell works. So you can like run command line things and have them work, and give people command line instructions and have them work. But it doesn't care about the implementation details. So in this class, we're going to be talking about how it was typically implemented on these operating systems derived from Unix. So I'll sometimes say, like, some things we'll talk about in the future are going to be system calls. But POSIX doesn't actually require anything be a system call, because it doesn't specify system calls. It specifies library functions, C functions you can call. It doesn't specify things like binary formats. It's about source compatibility. So the idea is that you write your source code once, and then you compile it for every single Unix, and it works, hopefully. But everything below your source code, how that works, is not specified. But for convenience in this class, we'll talk about what a typical implementation based on that original Unix would do. And I'll often take some shortcuts of saying like something's a system call when it might not be entirely true. So questions about POSIX? Okay. So I'm going to start by talking about process management. So we saw how we can have a process control block in something like XV6. And to manipulate processes, we're going to have some system calls that let us do important operations, like get information about a process, like process IDs, create processes, run programs. You might wonder, wait, why are those separate? Shouldn't those be the same thing? We'll talk about that. Waiting for a program to finish and killing a program, you know, stop terminating a program or exiting a program. So I'll start with the simplest one here. Get PID. So get PID gets the current process ID, and some of these other system calls are going to need a process ID. So this is how you get your own process ID. So you can call get PID. You need to include the appropriate header file, which I haven't shown here. You can look that up in the documentation. And then it returns an integer, which has a type PIDT. I'm just casting it so I know I'm passing the right type of argument to printf, so printf won't be confused. Now, you might say, how do I get other process IDs? Well, for what we're going to talk about, you're going to get that because if you created the process, you'll get the process ID from creating it. Otherwise, we're not going to have good solutions we'll talk about. Though, on a machine, you may have known about PS. So PS is list processes, and it lists their IDs along with their names. And it's the same process ID. So obviously, there's some way of getting the process IDs of other programs, but we're not going to talk about it, mostly because in POSIX, sadly, the best way is probably running PS. Okay, so that's getting current process. Then we have process creation. So I talked about how we create a new thread and therefore most of a new process in XV6. So what is the interface going to be for doing this from an application? And the POSIX's choice is that they have a library call called fork. And what fork does is it copies the current process. This might seem like a bad choice. We'll talk about that later. Copies the current process. So this means it returns twice. It returns once in the original process and once in the copy. Why does it return in the copy? Because when we make the copy, it has registers which say we're about to return from fork. When we run the copy, we return from fork in the copy, in addition to doing so in the original. Now, you need to be able to distinguish, am I in the original or the copy? And the way fork helps you do this is through its return value. So in the parent, it gives you the PID of the new child process. So this is how you learn that process ID. So you better put it somewhere if you care. And in the child, it returns 0 to indicate that you're not the parent. It also can return -1 if it fails. For example, let's say you're out of memory. And it duplicates everything between the parent and child, except for the process ID, and of course the return value gets set differently. And I mean everything. So we duplicate memory. Like, we don't share stacks, we have copies of the stack and the heap and the code. So a way you can think about this is that, let's say we're running a program, it has registers that were saved, it has a kernel stack stored somewhere, it has user memory, so we have, like, you know, a stack, a heap, and, you know, code allocated, and we have some open files. We'll talk about the organization of that probably next time, and other information. And fork is going to copy that process control block, and it's not going to be a shallow copy, it's going to be a deep copy. So we're actually going to copy all the memory too. So we're going to get a new kernel stack and new user memory that's a copy of the original for everything. So questions on procedure? So after we do that copy, remember, we have to return differently in the parent and the child. So on x86, the return, so in something like x86, the return value is going to be an EAX, and we're going to therefore edit EAX in the parent and child to have different values to set our different return values. And also in here, we're going to set a new PID. So questions? Yeah.
To create a new process, we need an existing process?
Yes. So question is, where does the first process come from? So POSIX, because it's only specifying how you write applications, doesn't specify. The traditional Unix way is that there's some special code to start the first program, which is typically called init, where the kernel will load a program at a particular location on disk and start it as the first program. Other questions? Okay. So it's fork. So here's an example of using fork. I have all the header files I need. So I call get PID, print out what my parent PID is. Then I call fork, and I have code which runs in the parent process and runs in the child process, and I have code in case fork fails, like we're out of memory. And so after I call fork, I know we're in the parent process. If I have a child PID, remember the child, we indicate that you're the child by returning zero here. So if I get a number that's greater than zero, that's a real process ID. So in that case, I print out my PID, parent of, you know, the child PID. In the child, this code, example code, prints out the child's PID in a new line. And then we have this else case, which if it's not zero and not greater than zero, so if it returns a negative number, which indicates an error, I call this perr function, which is going to print out fork failed, colon, and then an error message indicating what the current error is. This is stored in a special variable called erno. So an example output might be, maybe my parent PID is 100, and the child it creates is 432. So we'll have parent PID 100 printed before fork, and then the parent will print out something, and the child will print out something. Though it's not guaranteed to happen in this order. This is assuming the parent runs before the child, but that's not required. So questions about this code? Yeah?
How would you have both the parent and the child running if they're in, like, separate disk blocks?
Question is, how would I have both the parent and the child running? Remember, we copy the process. So one time we're going to switch to a process where the first if statement is true, And in the copy, the other side of the if statement is going to be run. And it just depends which ones we switch to when. Other questions? Yeah.
So the return value is 0 of the child, but not the process ID?
Question is, the return value of fork is 0 in the child, but not the process ID? Yes. 0 is just an indicator that you are the child.
But if the last one's a child, wouldn't that one have a, like, if the last one is a child of something, so if you call it, like, twice, would that, like, would you change the old one's value to...
So the question is, what if I call fork twice? So the return value of each call to fork is just about the process that particular call created. So it would be 0 from the call where you were the child of based on that particular call to fork where you were the new process created. And if you called it again, if you're the parent, it would not be 0. Yeah, it's just, did that call to fork create this process or not? Is what it being 0 indicates. Not, are you a child or something? Because it turns out, as we'll talk about later, every process except the first one created in Unix is going to be a child process. Yeah?
So it's only the good run after fork that's run, or like everything above?
Question is only the code that ran after fork that's run. So in the child process, because we copy the registers, one of the things we're going to copy is going to be a pointer to here, which is the program counter. So that's copied between the parent and the child. Okay. You have a question? Yeah.
How is this different from the alloc-proc function?
Question is, how is this different from the alloc-proc function? So on XV6, this is going to be implemented using the alloc-proc function. This is what the fork system call is going to call alloc-proc, and then it's going to do some work to do the copying of the data and make this all work. Yeah. Your question.
What's the distinction between a read and process? Because the very first thing you did in class, unless I misunderstood, was that we had to create a new thread.
Yes. So the question is, what's the distinction between a thread and a process here? So right now, we're going to be just talking about processes with exactly one thread, so there's not a real distinction. When we talk about multi-threading, we'll get into what happens. Now, in POSIX, processes can have multiple threads, and you might say, okay, so do we copy all the threads? Do we copy one of the threads? And the decision they made is that we copy only the current thread, and the other threads are discarded in the child, but still exist in the parents. Question is, can this print the child first and then the parent? Absolutely. Because we haven't specified when things get run, and we know that we switch based on like a timer, and who knows exactly when the timer happens. And speaking of that, here's an exercise. So I have a little code that calls fork, and I want you to give me 2 possible outputs of this code. So we call fork, we check if the PID is 0, and let's say, you know, we have parent process is 99, child is 100. Or the two possible outputs, and ignore things like crashing or like fork returning an error out of memory and so on. And as a hint, there are more than 2 possible outputs.
Actually, there'd be a child start.
Can someone give me one possible output? Any one thing this program could output. Okay, back there. So in child, you said?
Yeah.
In child, and then what? And then done. Okay, in child, there's a number. Oh, in child, yeah, then done. Okay. And then child, there's a number here. What's that number going to be? It's going to be either this one or this one. Which one? What? So 99 is the parent. Remember, fork returns the new. In the parent, which is running as PID 99, it's going to return 100 because that's the PID we need to find out about. The way I like remembering this is that we can call get PID to get our own PID. So fork returns the useful one, which is not our own. Yeah, so return the child's PID, and then after that, done. Yes, so notice that the first thing some people miss is that this done is run, it's run after this child code, and it's run after this parent code. If you didn't want it to run, you should have, exited or something. So it runs twice. So that is one possible output. Any others? Yeah. Child 100 done, and then in child done. Okay. So how about a third? Okay, back there. Yes. So the question is, can I switch between the two? Absolutely. So you're saying that we could have in child. Child 100, and then both duns together. Yeah. That's a third possible output. And there's a fourth if you swap those two child prints. And some of you might argue there's a fifth and a sixth if we imagine the two printfs get interleaved with each other, like we print out in child, in, and then child 100, child, And the reason why that can happen is that we're switching between these two programs, and depending on exactly how long we let them run before we switch, different things could happen. Yes? The 100? Why is it not 99? So fork returns so the return value here is in the parent, it's the new, that is the child PID, and the child, it's zero. So in the parent, it returns the new PID, which is the child one. And the way I remember it is that we can call get PID to get our own PID, so fork never gives that to us. Gives us something more useful. Okay, other questions? Yeah. Why do we return the PID to zero? Zero is the special value fork returns to indicate you are in the new process. And there wasn't a failure. Yeah. So other questions?
So fork will always run two different processes, the parent process and the child.
So the fork, so after fork returns, there will always be two different processes, assuming fork didn't run out of memory. Yeah. So the question is, what memory would run out? So if we so we need memory for this, we need memory for these, and if we don't have that, fork's going to have to fail.
But is it the memory allocated for the original process, or would it get its own?
So when we did this copy, we need to allocate a new process control block, so that takes up some memory, and we need to allocate new space for the actual memory of the program that we're going to copy into. So it's not memory for the original program, but yeah, we have a bunch of different types of memory we need to allocate. Yeah.
You're pointing in here soon, but I remember from CompArc that you fork a process, it doesn't
copy everything into.
So question is, you may have learned that, oh, there's this trick we can do where you don't actually do all this copying in the memory, and that's true, and we'll talk about that probably like after the midterm.
So my question would be then, does it tell if it's going to fail?
So the question is, if we're doing this, so there's a trick we can do where we could say, instead of doing this copying right away, let's do it later. We'll talk about how that works much later in the semester. And the question is, are we going to have fork fail if we know it's not going to work later? And the answer is, it depends. Different OSs make different choices about that. And there are cases you can make for both. The case for failing immediately is that it's how are we going to fail later? That seems inconvenient. The case for failing later is maybe the space will come up. And when we talk about virtual memory, we will talk a lot more about what really happens for that copy. And it turns out we're going to do something a bit more efficient. Which is going to be tied to how we generally manage memory for programs. So we have creating new programs. So next we're going to talk about running programs. And it seems like these should have been the same thing, but when we created a new program, we were running the same program. We usually want to run like a different program. Like if I type ls, I want to run the list files program, not whatever program I'm running right now. And the way we do that is with a bunch of functions whose names start with exec for execute. And what exec does is it doesn't create a new process. It replaces the current process is running with the new program. So it's the same PID, same process control block. We just edit the process control block to point to a new program. And the variant we'll talk about, there's several variants of exec which take their arguments in slightly different ways. I'm going to talk about execv, which takes a path, which is the location of the program to run. So it's the file that contains the executable code. And argv, which is an array of arguments. And this becomes exactly your argv in C, C's main function. It's exactly what to put there. And this is terminated by a null pointer, because execv has no other way of knowing how long your argv is. So you have to put a null pointer at the end so it can figure that out. And execv is most commonly used with fork, because usually when we run a program, we want to keep running the old program afterwards. And since execv replaces the program, the only way we can do that is by making a copy of the program before we do this replacement. So we have an original that can keep running and a copy we can replace. So for example, here's running the equivalent of ls minus l. So we fork, and the child process is going to be a copy of this program that you see the source code for here. And it's going to call execv with bin ls, which is that's the typical location of the ls program, the list files program, is in slash bin. And it's going to run it with the argv of ls as the first argument, argv of 0, and minus l as the second, which is just like running ls minus l from your Linux terminal. And if execv returns, that means it couldn't replace the program. Otherwise, it's going to start running ls instead. So if it returns, something went wrong. For example, maybe bin ls doesn't exist. Or maybe we run out of memory trying to start the new program. So in that case here, I print an error message and then exit the child program, because if I didn't exit the child program, then both the parent and the child would run code down here, and that would probably be very confusing. So we have our path, and so questions here? This code snippet, yeah.
So there always has to be a null at the end of
the question is there always has to be a null at the end of the args? Yes, because if you look at the prototype for execv, the second argument is a pointer to pointer that doesn't contain size information. And it's not going to guess, it's going to look for that null. Yeah.
So why is LS the first argument?
This question is, why is LS the first argument? There's a convention on Unix that the first argument is the name of the program that was typed when you were run. So if you ever tried to parse arguments on a Unix-like system, you've probably started with argv of 1. And this is why, because argv of 0 contains the name of your program by convention. Now, when I call execv, I can actually put anything I want there. But it's just a question of how is the LS program going to interpret that. Other questions? Okay, so that's exec. So what exec does as far as our process control block is that we're going to load the new program. We're going to set initial values for all our safe registers because we're just starting a program from scratch. We're not going to keep the current ones. So we're going to have a new stack, a new heap, and new user memory. And we're going to copy the arguments over onto typically the new stack. Could also put them somewhere else. Depends on how you decide to implement it. But we're going to copy the arguments over. And we're going to have to do that because after we set up the new program, we're going to discard the old program. And as part of doing this, although we change the current registers and the current memory, we're not going to change the open files, which is important because this is how, when you start a new program, it knows how to output to the terminal. It knows how to output because that's one of the already open files. And exec doesn't change whether or not that file is open. So questions, this process? Yeah. The question is, will exec ever change where the kernel stack is? This is an implementation decision. So XV6, I believe it doesn't, I recall correctly, but there are certainly implementations where you'd reallocate the kernel stack to. Yeah?
When we create that new user memory space, are we copying the old registers?
Question is, when we create that new user memory space, are we copying the old registers? So generally, no. And this is why I have sort of marked on this picture that we replace all the registers with their initial values. Because we went to start from main, so we set everything up the way the program expects to be run from main, whatever that is. Question?
If you create a new program, you have to set up the same files, then the new program has access to open files with the old program.
Question is, if we execute a new program with the same open files, it has access to the same files as the old program? Yes, it does. So if that's a security problem, you better close the files. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
What if the new process needs more space in memory?
Question is, what if the new process needs more space in memory? So there's a couple things going on. So one is that part of loading the program is going to be figuring out how much space we need to load it. So if we have a big executable, it's going to get more space in memory as part of the exec call, as part of this memory over down here, right? We'll just allocate more space if the executable says it needs more space. The other thing is that later on, we can make system calls to do things like make the heap bigger. And because of address translation, we don't actually have to make the heap bigger. We don't need to have space right here. We could put it up here for the extra heap space, because there's a mapping from the program addresses to that, so we can allocate the next address and not have it actually be adjacent in the real memory. Does that answer your question?
Didn't you just copy?
This question is, why didn't we copy the whole old memory? Because this is data for the wrong program. Right, because this is the shell, my shell, where I'm typing ls, a copy of that versus ls itself. And ls is going to have different global variables and so on. So we don't want to copy the shell's global variables and whatever it's on its stack, because ls doesn't care about that.
But when you
question is when we copy, so you're saying that, you're asking about this copy of the arguments. So what I mean by that is, is that I'm copying this. That's what I'm copying, just that array. So everything else I'm not copying. And that's going to be a pretty small portion of the program. And when I'm copying that, part of the reason I'm going to copy it and not just keep it where it is that I want to locate it in a place where main will expect to read it. And there's going to be a particular location we'll decide on, like commonly, like it will be at the top of the stack. And you want to put it exactly there. Okay, other questions? Yeah. The question is, do we need a... The question is, do we still need the kernel stack? We need a kernel stack because when we're running this new program, we need somewhere to go when an exception happens.
Yeah, like, do we keep the old one?
The question is, do we keep the old one? Do we keep the old kernel stack? So that is a valid choice, and I believe that's what XV6 does. It would also be a correct... You could have correct implementations where you choose a new kernel stack, though it might be a little more complicated to finish the exec system call. In that case, because you need to switch stacks as part of it, which you previously wouldn't need to do. Other questions? Okay, so fork exec, this is the traditional way of creating, starting a new program, like a shell would on Unix-like OSs. And you might say, gosh, that seems awfully complicated because we're copying the current program. And that might be pretty big, just to spawn a new program. Couldn't we just have a function to spawn a new program? And the answer is absolutely. In fact, this is what Windows does. Windows has a function called createProcess that creates a new program process running a different program, if you want that. POSIX even has one, which was introduced relatively recently, called POSIXSpawn. Now, the reason why original Unix liked fork, and why that was the standard API, is that as part of starting the new program, we want to set up the program state. So for example, if I want to run ls, I want to make sure ls is running in the correct directory. And if I want to run ls, I also want to make sure it's outputting to the right place. And without fork, you probably want some function to do things like set the current directory or change where the output of a program is so you could run it in the particular way you want to run it. And the solution in Windows is that, well, create process takes a lot of arguments so you can set all that stuff. Versus with fork, what we do instead is that before you call exec in the copy, you can change those settings. You can like change what the current directory is, you can change where the output's going. You can do all this work you want to do to manipulate the process before it starts running the new program. So that was sort of the elegance of the fork solution, is that we can just have our API to set up our current process, and that's all we need. We don't need a separate API to set how new programs run, which is kind of a thing that Windows ends up doing, is that create process takes all these extra arguments so you can run the process in just the right, with just the right environment. But, of course, the disadvantage is now we need this function to copy the current process. In addition to that, we have the overhead of doing those extra copies that might not be needed. So POSIX, as I said, eventually caught on that maybe this isn't a great idea. In particular, this copying is pretty inefficient on certain machines without address translation support, which POSIX wanted to support, even though that's not traditionally what Unix ran on. So POSIX has an API for this called POSIXSpawn, which takes, we can set, returns the error code, has a place where you want to put the new process ID, you say, I want to run this program with these arguments, and you can have separate variables for things like, here are the new files I want open. Here's where I want its output to go if it's different than the current program. Here are other settings like current directory I want to change. Here are something called environment variables, and so on. So it's just one unified function. And this seems like a nice idea. It turns out that support for this is not very good because historical Unix didn't have this. This is a recent addition. And most implementations of POSIX spawn call fork, or something very similar to fork, because that's what the kernel implements. And they just wrote a library that handled POSIX spawn. They call fork, or something called vfork, which is related to fork. Now, I'm bringing up this notion. So some people think that, they recognize that we might need an API to set the new state, but they say, really, really, fork was a mistake. So there's some people who really think fork was a mistake. So this is a paper from last year's HotOS conference, Hot Topics in Operating Systems, workshop by some relatively prominent people, who argue that fork was a clever hack for machines and programs of the 1970s that has long outlived its usefulness and is now a liability. So they really don't like it. Opinions vary. I would say, like, if we were designing Unix from scratch, maybe fork isn't a thing we would do in quite the same way. Even though it has some elegance, it does make other things inconvenient to do. Some questions on alternatives to fork. Okay, so finally, I have starting a new program. But if we think of like running ls, another thing which happens is we want to wait for that new program to finish. So there's a function for this called waitPID. There's also a bunch of other related ones. We're just going to talk about waitPID. There's also wait and a few others you might know of or look up. So waitPID, it takes a process ID, a pointer to something for a status, and options. So it waits for a child process to finish with a particular PID. So you get a PID from fork, and when you want to wait for that program to finish, you call waitPID with its PID, and waitPID won't return until it's done. And when it is done, it's going to set the status pointer, status integer that you passed a pointer to contain information about how it terminated. So most notably, this will tell you, like, did it segfault, did it terminate normally, and so on. So if you've seen the message segmentation fault on your shell, what happened is your shell forked, it execed a program, and it called waitPID, and waitPID set the status to say it segfaulted. And the shell printed out segmentation fault because of that. So waitPID has some flexibility. So one thing is that you can pass a PID of -1 to indicate wait for the first thing that finishes. So if you forked more than once, you'll have multiple processes you can wait for, and it will wait for them. You might say, what if I want to wait for a program that I didn't fork? Well, you can't do that. WaitPID requires a child process that this current process called fork. If you want to wait for another process, you have to have its parent process wait for it. Or find some other way of figuring out if it terminated. Yes?
So what if you had a parent that made 4 child processes, but you only want to return from 2 of them? Is there a way to make an array instead of saying -1, just all of them?
The question is, can I wait for a list of processes not directly? So typically, programs that want to do that will call it with -1. And when you call it with -1, it returns the PID that you actually waited, that you actually terminated, and you'll use that information to figure out what to do. So if you want to wait for particular programs, one you can do, more than one, you basically usually you wait for everything and figure out what actually finished with the return. So there's also an options variable. I'm not going to talk about exactly what they are. You can see the manual page. Most notably, there's a way of instead of sleeping until the program finishes, of just finding out, did it finish now or not? Okay. So since we have this status information, it's worth talking about what does that mean? And this is where, most notably, the return value of like main comes in. Where does that zero go? That's where it goes, into that status. So here's our typical uses. Wait, we call fork, and we get a child PID, we wait with a particular status, and then we want to interpret that status to figure out what the program did. And since I told you that when we return zero for main, that's where the status goes, you might say, okay, so I just print out star status, the status, and that's gonna be what was returned for main. That's not quite true. And this is because programs can terminate for different reasons. So they can terminate because like they exited from main, or they can terminate like because they segfaulted or you press control C, and the status variable integer is going to encode all that information. And wait has a bunch of macros, which start with a capital W, to let you figure out what does a status mean. So there's an if exited, which tells you did it return from main or call exit. And if so, you can use this exit status to get the return value from main or the argument to exit. And then there's this other option called signaled. And most other ways of terminating programs involve a POSIX mechanism called signals, which we won't go into much detail about. And this includes segfaults. So if it's signaled, this is like abnormal termination, and you can get the signal number, which indicates the type of abnormal termination it is. And there might be some other possible things, but it's unlikely. But it encodes all this information, so it's not just going to be the number returned for main, because it has to encode did it was a return or was it like a segfault or a control C or something like that. So to mention signals briefly, so they're mainly a way of communicating between processes, so that's where the name comes from, is that you can signal another process of something. But they're also how abnormal termination happens. And the rationale is that a segfault is not actually the kernel just terminating your program. It's the kernel informing you that, hey, you accessed invalid memory. And it's just that the default reaction of your program to that is being terminated. You can set different reactions, but probably not usefully. So that's why it uses the signals mechanism, that the kernel tells you, hey, your program did something weird. What do you want to do? And if you don't set a response to that, it kills your program. So sig segv is the signal the kernel sends on segmentation fault, but these are also used for example, control C is sig int, is you just got a control C, what do you want to do? The fault action is your program gets killed, and there's a few others. There's sig term, which is what the kill command, which you may have used to terminate another program, does by default. And you've seen bus error, that's a different signal to indicate you did something, you know, some wrong memory access, and so on. Okay, so questions about exit statuses? So I mentioned that you can call wait PID with a negative one to wait for all your children. So a typical way you might see this done is you can, you know, have this loop where you just say, get the child PID. If it's minus one, that's an error. Otherwise, figure out what is child PID and handle it exiting. So this is like, if you wanted to wait for lots of children in the order they finish, you can do it this way. Okay, so this gives us our typical way that we actually start new programs, is that we have our parent process, we call fork, that creates a child process, and I'm using these little squigglies to represent a thread, like someplace where our program executes one line, the next, and the next. And our child process does some setup, then calls exec, and that program usually exits, and then we call wait PID in the parent process sometime while the child process is running. And wait PID returns when the child process finally finishes and tells us about how it exited. So nominally, time is going down. But remember that since we have two separate threads, We don't know exactly when they'll run, so we could imagine that this is going to look like, you know, the parent, we have our child process, and it like finishes executing before the parent calls wait PID, and that's perfectly fine. Yeah, things will still work the same. Because they're running independently, that could happen. They could run at different speeds, rerun more often or less often, depending on how timers work out, and so on. Okay. So this gives us code like this, where you call fork, we have one side of the fork, the child side, which does an exec, and goes to another program, and the other side, which does typically a wait PID, where we just want to run that one program and wait for it to finish. Now, we might use a slightly different pattern if we want to run multiple programs at the same time. So one example is like if I want to spawn multiple programs in parallel, which is something you'll need to do for the shell assignment, then I can call fork one time for each one, in each child, call exec, and not wait right away, because if I want them to run at the same time, there's no reason to wait right until I'm ready for them to finish. You know, I don't care about them finishing yet, don't wait yet. And just wait later in some way. Okay. Let's wait. Now, we can see from this that we have these child processes that we've spawned, and they're kind of important because the parent process remains responsible for calling wait to figure out what its child processes did. And this means that because we need to know who can call wait, the kernel needs to track a parent process for every process. So every process, except process ID 1, that first program which runs, has a parent process. And in fact, there's a library called getppid to tell you what that is, if you didn't record it earlier. And this is the single process that can wait for it. Other processes, you can call waitPID with that PID, but it will return an error saying, sorry, it's not yours. And because we have processes with child processes, this creates a tree. And here, like this is a very small visualization of the tree from the pstree command, which is just reading all the processes and figuring out what are the childs, and you get this sort of tree going all the way up to process ID 1, the first process. Now, since we have this relationship, you might say, well, what if certain things happen? So let's say, what if the parent exits before the child finishes? This is allowed, and the child will continue running. But the child needs to have a parent process ID, because I said we always have one. So the decision that Unix has made is that it's going to be 1. But we're going to make its parent be the first process. And the first process will usually run a loop where it will collect the exit statuses and maybe print a message somewhere so you can figure out what happened. So what if the parent never calls wait PID? Well, we don't know when the parent's going to be able to call wait PID. I told you like we could run for a while before that wait PID call happens. So the kernel is going to have to keep the information about how the child exited around until wait PID gets called. And if it never gets called, well, it's going to keep it around until it knows that it's never going to be called, which is going to be as long as the parent program is running. And this is what's sometimes known as a zombie, because we can't reuse the PID. So instead, we're going to keep that PID reserved in order to not have any conflicts with it. Because we want you to be able to pass that PID to wait PID and not be confused about what process are you referring to. So we'll reserve the PID until you wait for it. Yeah. Question is, what if the child finishes before the wait PID call? Then it gets kept around until the wait PID call is ready to finish. Okay. And if a non-parent tries to wait PID for a program, it's going to fail. Wait PID is just going to return an error and say, nope, can't do that. So questions? Yeah. Kristen, why is there a restriction that a parent can only wait for its own child? So this is presumably to simplify who you have to tell about a child finishing. Also, if we let other programs wait, there's a question of what is the normal parent going to have happen. It does turn out that there are ways on most modern Unixes like Linux of circumventing this, but they're sort of complicated. And in Linux, I know the API I know exists for debugging, debuggers, for example, which is not a typical case. Yeah, question? The question is, if the parent process X is for the child, that child's parent process is 1, meaning process ID 1 can wait for it. So you're saying what happens to other child, like other childs of the same parent?
Yeah.
All of those processes have their parent process become PID 1. So basically, process ID 1 replaces the original process as far as being able to wait. Other questions? Okay. And finally, we have our last two things. So there's an xset, which xsets the program. We've seen that. Takes an exit status. And there's kill, which sends that signal to abnormally terminate a program or possibly send a message. But we won't talk about how that works. Okay. So since we've talked about fork and exec, let's do a little exercise here. So what are possible outputs? This code, which calls bin echo, which prints out its arguments. So who thinks A, B, C, D, E, F, no, G, just no guesses, okay. H, so this code here, we have a loop that's executed twice, where we call fork, and in the child process, where fork returns 0, we exec echo with the args of this arg replaced by either L1 or L2. That extra of I. So we're going to call echo of L1 and then echo of L2 in the child. And remember, exec doesn't return, it just starts running echo. Echo's going to exit, and that's going to exit, you know, the whole process. So the child will never go beyond this point since exec doesn't fail. So in the parent process, after we start both of those programs, then we wait for them. So we're going to have one program which wants to print out L1, one which wants to print out L2, and we don't know what order they're going to run in. So both A and C, that's an edit that. A and C and the useless D, which should have been maybe something else, are going to be possible outputs. So we have, you know, A and C are both possible. B is not because we only spawn one copy of the L2 program. So that's what I have for today. So next time we'll talk about files, how files are managed in POSIX, and about shells.